Welcome to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dori Smith. Today we will hear part two of an interview with former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter. This interview took place after Ritter's January 24, 2006 talk at West Hartford Town Hall. I joined community media activist John Holder of WWUH Radio in West Hartford and Helder Mira of Newspeak TV, Hartford Public Access. We asked Ritter questions about the war in Iraq, foreign policy under George W. Bush, and the media. I took the first question in this section of our interview.
We are hearing a little bit about Iran, about the CIA attack on Pakistan, and about some of what's going on rhetorically between Israel, the U.S., and Iran, Russia, and China in the background. As this goes on the surface, what kinds of things could the Bush administration actually do in a deep way? What could people doing the job that you used to do engage in now to bring us toward national and international security rather than away from it?
The fact is the Bush administration is not equipped to do this because, you know, the Bush administration uses certain themes for their own political benefit. To give you an example, disarmament, non-proliferation. These are buzzwords that are thrown out there, and they're buzzwords that are designed to confuse the American public, and indeed the Congress of the United States and the rest of the world. Who would be against a policy of disarmament? Who would be against a policy of non-proliferation? You can't go against these things because it makes sense from a national security perspective, from a global security perspective. But the Bush administration doesn't have a policy of disarmament, doesn't have a policy of non-proliferation. In fact, if you take a look at the Bush administration's records, we have walked away from disarmament treaties, and we have failed to enforce non-proliferation standards. We have a very selective enforcement of these non-proliferation standards. There's actually extremely wide proliferation of weapons of mass destruction technology taking place, and we have a situation where the world is arming, not disarming. So disarmament has been played on its head. Why? Because the Bush administration has a policy of global domination, I'm not making it up. That's a harsh charge, but just read the national security strategy that was put forward by the Bush administration in September 2002 and come up with a different definition. You can't. It's global domination. And so the only way the Bush administration could, you know, enact policies that were beneficial to the notion of international peace and security is for the Bush administration to walk away from the national security strategy that was put forward in September 2002. They need a new national security strategy. It's for the Bush administration to reject global domination, reject the notion of this modern American empire, and then to sincerely embrace legitimate disarmament and nonproliferation policies. And this means not only dictating to the rest of the world that they can't have weapons of mass destruction, etc. It means taking the lead. Rather than developing new families of nuclear weapons that we call usable nukes and coming up with a new nuclear utilization policy that says we can use nuclear weapons preemptively in a non-nuclear environment, we should go back to no first use, and we should go back to the notion of let's get rid of nuclear weapons. We should live up to our obligations and responsibilities under the Non-Proliferation Treaty when we said nations can develop nuclear peaceful nuclear technology, and those nations that have nuclear weapons should be actively working to get rid of these nuclear weapons. Here we are talking about potential military action against Iran, a nation that has signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and is abiding by the law of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and yet we're talking about holding them accountable while we accelerate our development of nuclear weapons-related technology. The Bush administration is just a walking, talking contradiction.
There are some who believe that Iran is a growing threat. Would you comment on the whole issue of whether or not it would be a good idea to use international alliances like the U.S. with Putin to go ahead and allow Iran to develop nuclear power if it can be contained where proliferation of arms is concerned?
First of all, let's talk about Iran as a growing threat. I view Iran as a growing threat. I'm not one of these people that says everything's hunky-dory with the Iranian government. It's not. We have a long, difficult history between the United States and this government. It doesn't mean it's all the Iranian government's fault. It doesn't mean it's all America's fault. It's a complicated history of relationship. And the end product of it is that the United States has created the conditions vis-a-vis American-Iranian relations that are pushing us towards the edge of the cliff. You know, we haven't given ourselves a diplomatic out because we're talking about regime change. We're talking about getting rid of the theocrats in Tehran. Why is this important? Because you bring up the issue of Russia's offer. You know, right now the international community is engaged in increasing the pressure on Iran regarding a nuclear energy program that some have articulated as a nuclear weapons program. Russia has come in and said if the basis of the opposition is that Iran must be denied access to a nuclear fuel cycle that can be converted to a nuclear weapons program, then why don't we do the part, you know, parts of the fuel cycle in Russia so that Iran doesn't control that technology? If we were genuinely concerned about disarmament and nonproliferation, this would be a brilliant diplomatic measure that should be widely supported by everybody. But you'll find that that the Bush administration is going to be skeptical about this, is going to come out against it. They're not going to embrace it because it's not about disarmament. It's not about nonproliferation. It's about regime change. And the Bush administration is using the fear generated by the rhetoric about a nuclear weapons program to stoke American public support for holding Iran to account. And so I think we need to be careful about digging too deeply into this notion of, you know, diplomacy and, you know, disarmament and a solution with the Russian, because ultimately none of it will succeed until the United States backs away from its policy of regime change and says, look, we will put legitimate national security interests before politicized ideology. We will support a peaceful resolution to the Iranian problem that successfully deals with the nuclear issue, even if it keeps the Iranian government in place or even strengthens their hand. But this is the mistake that we made with Iraq. We had everybody believing the Bush administration when it said, you know, we're seeking a diplomatic solution. We're going to give UN weapons inspectors a chance, et cetera. They never intended for any of that to work because they had a policy objective of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. And on Iran, we have a policy objective of getting rid of the Iranian theocrats.
Newspeak TV producer Helder Mira of Hartford Community Access Television.
You yourself tried to go to the New York Times to Judith Miller, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, to before the start up to the war and present your case against it. And how has your interaction been with the media and how you see their almost culpability following conservative agenda and this agenda for war, be it conservative or even this democratic agenda for war? And my follow-up would be, in going for this regime change, which the administration can just come out and say, this is what we want regime change, what do they hope to acquire within this, I guess, empirical power that they seek? And are you familiar with the Project for a New American Century? Do you see any of that evolving in this?
The Project for a New American Century 1997 vision statement is almost word for word the national security strategy of the United States that became policy in 2002. So there's a direct link. The people that wrote the national security strategy are the same people who drafted the policy statement of PNAC in 1997. They're the same people who drafted the 1992 Department of Defense vision statement that is the ultimate foundation for, you know, these actions. What do they hope to achieve? Global domination. That's what it's all about. This is about, you know, a new American empire, you know, the new Rome, Pax Americana, whatever you want to call it. It's about what it's really about, if you want to parse it out, is America's total disregard for the other nations and other peoples of the planet. We think that this big blue marble that we occupy is ours. We own it, and everybody else has to do our bidding. And it's going to come as a harsh shock to the ignorant masses that populate these 50 states when they realize that there's several billion people out there who don't share that common vision. They don't view themselves as a colony of the United States or the subjects of an American emperor, and they're going to react violently, and the war will come home. That's something that we have to realize, that if we remain silent while our government puts forward, you know, these policies, we will pay the price. And it's not just the government, though. The media is extremely culpable in all of this. the New York Times. You know, they editorialized in favor of the war. You know, you had somebody like Judith Miller, who became, you know, not a reporter, but a facilitator of selling the war. You know, the New York Times took a stance where anybody who spoke out against this war would be ridiculed, put down. You know, they sicked a Pulitzer Prize-winning attack dog named Barry Barak on me. You know, did a traveled around with me for 2 weeks, and then published in New York Times Magazine a story. You know, on Scott Ritter's Iraq. You know, fixation or something like that, but, you know, basically trying to portray me as unstable and inconsistent, etc. You know, total deviation from what he saw, but that was his job. His job was, from his editors, to marginalize Scott Ritter. CNN had the same job. You know, I went to CNN's headquarters and met with 60 of their top executives, all their talking heads, in September 2002. And, you know, they put me on trial, so to speak, for my position. I defended it well, and they said, you know, we're allowed to put Scott Ritter on the air. But when they put me on the air, it wasn't to say, you know, Scott Ritter, expert on Iraq. It was so Paul Azan could say, Scott Ritter, you drank Saddam's Kool-Aid. Or is that you could have Tucker Carlson, you know, selectively misquote you. You know, CNN wasn't there to be an honest broker. CNN was selling a war. Why do I say selling a war? Because at the end of the day, you have to understand this. The New York Times is a business. The Washington Post is a business. CNN is a business. CBS News is a business. That means they have to make money. And war is a great money-making vehicle for mass media. The masses tune in. They buy newspapers. They buy magazines. And they watch the shows. And when you have somebody who is you know, articulating against the war, you have somebody who's threatening your bottom line. And that's what I was, a threat to their bottom line, because they didn't care about the facts. They didn't care about the reality. They cared about the perception. And I was a threat to that perception. The other thing is, even when you don't have war, the news cycle itself is very, you know, news is a very competitive business. You know, the daily news cycle is driven more and more by the government. It's what the Bush administration chooses to release to the press that drives the news cycle. So you become addicted to your government sources of information. What happens if you have somebody who's taking on the government and you suddenly give them credence? Your sources from the government are going to dry up. You're not taking the lead. People aren't going to watch you. You may have done the right thing, the honorable thing, the thing with integrity, but it's bad for business. And that's what happened here. The news media is a business. They're there to make money. They're there to keep the stockholders happy, and you know, they're not going to embrace the ramblings of an individual, regardless of how right that individual is.
Have you seen any news, like any news outlet that has done decent coverage of that you would find to have fair coverage of the Iraq war and the Iraq situation?
Yeah, Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera has done the most honorable, accurate, balanced reporting on Iraq. You know, the Bush administration loves to call Al Jazeera an Al-Qaeda outlet. You know, Al Jazeera got kicked out of Iraq by Saddam Hussein and then threatened to be bombed by George W. Bush. If a mad dictator in Baghdad hates him and a mad dictator in Washington, D.C. hates him, Al Jazeera is doing something right. I think Al Jazeera did well. The BBC did okay. You know, and some other European outlets did all right. But no, I can't say that there's an American group that did well. People come in and say, well, what about Amy Goodman and Democracy Now? And what about all this? No, I love Amy Goodman. I love Democracy Now. But, you know, until she steps away from her ideology, she's not a news person. She's a left-wing ideologue who promotes stories that beat up on the Bush administration. They might be accurate stories. She might be telling the truth, but it's not news. She's more of an advocate than she is a reporter. We don't have a fair and balanced, and I hate to use that terminology because I've been hijacked by Fox News, but we don't have a fair and balanced news media outlet on a major scale here in the United States. We simply don't have it.
WWUH West Hartford radio producer John Holder.
Getting back to what my colleagues here and you have said, there's a move in the peace movement to try to have the troops withdrawn from Iraq, and I believe Afghanistan as well. What about the possibility that what happened in the 70s with Richard Nixon occurs in terms of troops were withdrawn and then the U.S. engages in massive carpet bombing of Iraq and Afghanistan?
We see that happening now. One of the reasons why our troops are dying in the levels they are is that we don't let them do aggressive patrolling. We forgot that we're at war. I mean, there's a way to fight a war, and we're experts at that. Our troops are confined to bases. They take these mad dashes down roads that get blown up by IEDs when we're not securing the highways because the Pentagon is concerned about the domestic political impact of these casualties because Americans are saying, why are the troops dying? So in an effort to reduce casualties, it's not just about getting the numbers of troops reduced, but we replace them with an increasing reliance on air power. If you take a look at the number of combat sorties that have been flown in Iraq and Afghanistan lately, they've increased dramatically. You know, this is good from one perspective, the military perspective, that you got an airplane dropping bombs, it's sort of, you can't touch it. The Iraqis have nothing, that the insurgents can't touch it. It reduces our casualties and it achieves, you know, some sort of effect. But what effect does it achieve? You know, the bombs are only as good as the targeting data that are used. What are we dropping bombs on? If we continue to drop bombs the way we have in the past on villages and killing innocent civilians and have the media call them terrorists when in fact they're just innocent Iraqis, that produces more insurgents. You know, this bombing campaign is going to be, it's counterproductive completely. It's going to kill innocents. It's not going to impact the insurgency. It's actually going to aid the insurgency. So again, this comes back to the argument about what are we doing in Iraq? We have a military campaign that's not designed to achieve victory. It's being fought for to achieve some sort of political image-making back here in the United States. Why are we having troops die for this, and why are we killing Iraqis for this? I hate war, but you know, if you're going to go to war, do it. Get the job done. And if innocent civilians die, that's just that's the horror of war. The sooner we get it done, the sooner we stop killing innocent civilians. But with Iraq, there seems to be no rush to victory. There's no way of defining victory. What are we trying to achieve? And that's the problem, is that we keep having strategies put forward in Iraq that aren't about achieving victory on the ground. They're about achieving victory in the public relations war that's being waged here at home.
If you were to talk to a young person in high school, what would you tell them about enlisting in the armed forces of the United States?
I would say that military service is one of the greatest gifts you can give to your country. It's one of the most honorable things you can do. That when you join the military, you take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. So you become the guarantor of the American people about the freedoms we enjoy. It's a huge responsibility, and we the people are asking much of you, because we will ask you to put your life on the line in defense of our country. But don't worry. We the people will back you up and make sure that we never send you abroad to engage in a conflict that's not worthy of the sacrifice. That's the theory. That's what makes military service honorable. Today, we don't have those conditions. If you join the military today, you're not joining an organization that's dedicated to defending the Constitution or defending the American people. You're a personal play toy to an imperial president that will use you as he sees fit, not as Congress sees fit, not in the best interest of the American people. I would advise strongly against joining the military, because to join the military, you become nothing more than a Roman legionnaire in support of the new Rome. You're not an American fighting man defending America. And this is harsh, but this is the facts. If you join the military today, be fully aware of what you're doing. It's not this greater service to God and country. You're becoming a legionnaire of, you know, Emperor Bush, and you know, you will suffer the consequences.
Elder Mita of Newspeak TV, do you foresee the idea of once we start pulling out troops, they've already started going in, but these sort of like black op type of low-end security, former Marines or former military personnel working as security officers for such organizations as Halliburton and other American interests there, that sort of have carte blanche to do what they wish because they're no longer upheld, or they don't have to be held up to military standards or American international treaties? And two, do you, with this sort of bleak view, what promising outlook do you have to offer?
Well, first of all, I would say that we need to be honest about what's going on in Iraq. We've got the third largest presence of foreign troops in Iraq is these security contractors, mercenaries. And there's no other term to use. A lot of friends are doing that. And when we sit down and talk, they talk as if they're, doing, God's work, America's work. You're not doing America's work. You only do America's work if you wear the American uniform, if you get paid by the American government, if you got the American flag sewn on your uniform. You're a mercenary. You're doing some corporate entities work. You're scum. Bottom line is you're scum. You used to be a person of honor. You're now a mercenary. You're taking the buck to do the job, and it's a horrible job. They can only sustain the levels that they have because of the presence of American troops. The mercenaries aren't capable of doing a sustained stand-up fight with the insurgents. And if we withdraw, I don't see them increasing. They're going to decrease because they're going to get slaughtered. They're already getting slaughtered. It's a very dangerous situation that they face in Iraq today. And so the time of the mercenaries is over. With the withdrawal of American forces in Iraq, the mercenaries are going to withdraw because they can't survive. They can't stay in there. They won't have a base. The insurgents will defeat them, piecemeal. That's just the reality. Do I see anything positive? No. Nothing at all. I mean, you keep struggling, hoping that an opportunity will present itself. You don't give up, but we're sitting here drowning in an underwater cavern, running out of air, and we haven't found an exit to get to the surface yet. Do we give up and just say, okay, we're going to die, or do you keep scrambling, trying to find that exit? Well, I'm scrambling to try and find the exit. I haven't given up, but I haven't found an exit. I don't even have a hope of an exit right now. It's a very bleak situation that we find ourselves in.
You mentioned the Times, New York Times, and C-SPAN, and just now you mentioned Pacifica Radio. What about the rabid right wing? How have you been treated by them? People like Hannity and Bill O'Reilly.
I mean, Sean Hannity is a lunatic, and therefore I could care less how I get treated by Sean Hannity. He just doesn't play on my radar screen. Bill O'Reilly, more complicated. I know a lot of people have a visceral hatred for Bill O'Reilly. I don't. I don't agree with what he says. But I will say this. The times that I've been on Bill O'Reilly's program, he's allowed me to speak. He's disagreed with me. He's always come off worse for the wear. He lost every single debate we had. But one of the last exchanges we had was about the issue of WMD. And he said, look, your former Marine, a stand-up guy. He loves to say stand-up guy. And he goes, but you're saying things that have potential to do great harm to the troops. If we go to war with Iraq and chemical weapons are used, will you come on my show and apologize to the American people for the stance you've taken? I said, absolutely, I'll do that. So, but Bill, if we go to Iraq, war to Iraq, and there are no WMDs, will you bring me back on and apologize to me and the American people about the stance you've taken? Yes, will, I will. Well, we went to war, there were no WMDs, and while Fox wouldn't let him bring me on, Bill O'Reilly did go on Good Morning America and say Scott Ritter was right about there being no WMD. So, there is some honor out there, even honor among thieves, so to speak. But we have to understand this, that with some few exceptions, the right-wing media isn't there to... I mean, I'll say this for Amy Goodman. She has a whole lot of integrity, a tremendous amount of integrity. Amy Goodman's not going to put a lie on her show. And Amy Goodman has given me some hard times in questioning. She'll parse through. She does her research. And if she finds any contradictions, she's jumping on you, et cetera. So, she is biased. I will say that. But she's biased with absolute integrity. The right-wing media is not biased with integrity. They're just biased. And they're not independent. Amy Goodman is independent. The right-wing media operate all marches to the same drumbeat. It's drumbeat put out by, the conservatives, the neoconservatives. They mass mail, email the talking points, and they all do it. You listen to Rush Limbaugh, you listen to Sean Hannity, you listen to Bill O'Reilly, they all have the same talking points. They're very well organized. But what it means is that, we can't personalize this. You can't say this is about Sean Hannity being, mean to me or Bill O'Reilly being mean. No, it's about the right-wing media machine being irresponsible. Let's not personalize this. Let's not make it about Scott Ritter. Let's make it about the right-wing media machine that's been irresponsible across the board on every single issue, not just Iraq and weapons of mass destruction.
when we see someone like Ann Coulter, also appearing on Fox, but saying things about nuking Iran, or she was asked whether or not she had heard the story of the U.S. targeting journalists in Iraq, and she said, would that it were so. Let me ask you, is it that she is, in a way, being a clown, so that as a clown, she gets that kind of statement out there about nuking Iran, and then everyone sort of doesn't take that seriously? Then the equation for that truth is lowered, you know, because people automatically think of this nutcase out there. And it's interesting. Why would she do that? Who's putting her up to it?
Well, I'll say this right off the start. Ann Coulter has a right to say anything she wants to. She's protected by the same freedom of speech that you and I are protected by. And so, you know, I'm not someone who sits there and says we should muzzle Ann Coulter, we should shut her up, we should get her off the air. No. Obviously, there's a base out there that likes to hear what Ann Coulter has to say, and she's playing to that base. You know, it's a very demeaning base. I don't know if Ann Coulter understands what kind of joke she's become, this miniskirt-wearing thin blonde who's exuding sexuality on TV, saying the dumbest things in the world, therefore becoming the living manifestation of every dumb blonde joke that ever existed. You know, she pretends to be some sort of articulate, smart, legal authority, but she's a joke. Tragically, there's an entire constituency here in the United States that likes to hear thin, dumb, blonde girls spout trivial banality, and she's playing to that. You know, and that's why she does it, because there is a core audience out there in this massive ignorance, this seething massive ignorance we call the American people, who are receptive to what Ann Coulter has to say.
And yet she's supported by Republicans, has a close affinity to the Republican Party, is a member of the Federalists Society, and was last in Connecticut supported by the Clare Booth Luce Society. So she has some big support in George Bush's party.
Ann Coulter's part of a machine. And one of the things that you have to give the Republicans and the neoconservatives credit for is their organizational capability and their ability to stay consistent on message. Coulter's a message person. She's one of those little robots that get programmed to spew a message. And they've built this deeply integrated system of support that feigns legitimacy. So they bring in the Federalists, they bring in these different groups, and they say they support Ann Coulter, but they don't support Ann Coulter. They support the machine, and the machine puts up Ann Coulter, and therefore required to support, you know, whatever the machine says they support. Again, we're wrong to sit here and say this is about Ann Coulter. She's not smart enough. She doesn't have enough depth to function as an individual. You remove Coulter from the machine, Coulter becomes nothing. I'd love to see Ann Coulter do what I do. Get out there and do it on your own with no support. She couldn't last a day because no one would listen to her. She's part of a machine that, you know, puts her forward, and she's part of a broader spectrum that the machine plays to. As I said, there's a constituency out there that wants to look at skinny, blonde, dumb girls spout banalities because they think it's sexy, they think it's cool. The same people that like to see, you know, girls toting machine guns while wearing wet T-shirts. It's stupid. It makes no sense. But they're there. They love it. What do you want to call them? You want to call them the NASCAR crowd? You want to call them dumb rednecks? That's demeaning to NASCAR fans. That's demeaning to rednecks. I'm a redneck. You know, I'm a thinking redneck, though. I'm somebody who actually understands the Constitution, the rule of law, and understands my duties and responsibilities as a citizen. But there are a lot of people out there who are hardworking, honest people, who, when they come home and turn on the TV, don't want to listen to Scott Ritter and a bunch of other, you know, people spew facts and figures. They want to be entertained.
You've been listening to part two of a three-part special, a community media interview with Scott Ritter, former weapons inspector in Iraq. You can listen to part three of this broadcast in upcoming Talk Nation radio programs. Talk Nation airs Wednesdays at 5 p.m. on WHUS stores. Radio for the people at the University of Connecticut. I'm Dori Smith.